Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case. Well, hello again. Welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Linda, and today I'm joined by Stephanie, Teresa, Nicola, Pat, and Heather.
Hi!
This week on Write Club, Stephanie will be reading to us from a work in progress, after which we will offer her our comments, just as we do in our Write Club meetings. Heather will tell us the difference between Cajun and Creole language, which I think is going to be very interesting. We will talk about memoir versus the novel versus fiction, and we're going to hear what Pat and Helen Sutters are reading at the moment. But first, Nicola is going to ask us to
name the novel.
The author of this series of books was born on the 3rd of October 1916 in Sunderland, County Durham, England.
Scribble, scribble.
Teresa immediately.
She's not scribble, off already.
Scribble, yeah. Okay.
James Alfred Wright worked as a ship plater and a pianist for local cinema. But eventually he moved to Thirsk in Yorkshire, which proved to be the setting for most of his following books.
I've just crossed out Catherine Cook's.
Okay, shall I give you the third and final clue?
I'm wrong. Somebody that was born in 1908.
1903 in
1903
Sunderland.
In Sunderland, then moved to Yorkshire.
Yeah, and was a shipwright and a pianist. And
yeah. In 1939, at the age of 23, the author qualified as a veterinary surgeon with Glasgow Veterinary College, right, which informed the content of all his later books.
Right, I've got it.
I think we've all got it.
Oh, Linda, come
it's
on.
All Creatures Great and Small.
It certainly is.
James Herriot.
Yes. Very good. It all came on the third clue,
did it? The first two gave me absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they were memoirs, so that's why the first this week.
Yeah. I loved them. I loved them. All those wonderful little animals. Yeah.
And the people were just as good.
Oh, they were. They were. Yeah. Well, thank you, Nicola. That was an interesting one. As I promised, we're going to hear Stephanie read from her current work.
Okay, well, actually, I decided, because I'm a member of a memoir group, and so I thought, as we're talking about memoir today, I would share with you a piece of writing that I did a little while ago for our memoir group. It's not polished, and so I'm hoping that you'll be able to give me lots of clues, but it's actually about a true event from my rather wayward teenage years, and I called it What Fred Saw. The old gentleman walking down past Pump Lane School on this particular July afternoon would have heard us before he saw us. Above the tinnitus in his fog-filled ears would have come the distant rumble of hundreds of black-brogued feet. Perhaps he mistook it for thunder and quickened his step to be home before the rain. We usually ambled out in small groups, trading affectionate insults and occasional punches, our satchels of books slung over our shoulders, unloved burdens. On this day, we were like horses champing at the bit to get into the race. I wish I could describe a herd of fine thoroughbreds, lusty conker brown Arabian stallions, or proud Palomino mares with their tan coats sleek over rippling muscle and sinew. There may have been one or two of those in our number, but mostly we were frisky Gymkhana ponies eager to please, bored riding school nags, cart horses scruffy from a day's work, ponies longing to grow into beautiful bays, the occasional unbroken piebald or wild mustang. If the old gentleman, I'll name him Fred, had turned in the direction of the sound, he would have seen every door on the school building burst open, and the sound of excited youth would have reached him as he watched tributaries of youngsters joining the stream which headed his way. Between Fred and us, there were two large metal gates standing open across the driveway which led to the staff car park and the main school buildings. It was the last day of the summer term, so those gates marked the way to freedom and 6 weeks of illicit smoking in cherry orchards. Fred probably expected the torrent of teenagers to pool at the gates and then trickle off in different directions, like a river at an estuary. But that day, the pond grew into a sea of schoolchildren at the threshold of the world. Young men, faces rough with stubble and pink pimples, swung large metal gates together, barring the way between school and houses. Boys sat atop red brick, hauling squealing girls up and over, the only route left to escape the term time prison. Blazer pockets disgorged padlocks, chains, and other tools of confinement with shouts of merriment. Along with the metalwork, ropes and strings were tied in complex knots. Even the odd, no longer needed school tie was used to secure those gates. Padlock keys were flung lazily into nearby drains. Numbers on combination locks scrambled to make a game of guesswork necessary to open them. We conspirators were so numerous that Fred would have been unable to single out any ringleaders if asked to identify culprits. They were boys in black blazers, he'd shrug. I like to think Fred would have smiled as wide as we did as he went on his way, chuckling that today it was the staff in detention.
Excellent.
That's wonderful.
And
wonderful.
Actually, I just want to put a shout out there to anybody that was at Gillingham Technical High School that day in the summer of 1975. And apologies to anybody who's at Rain and Mark Grammar School now, because apparently they still don't let the whole school out at once at the on the last day of term. Nobody knows why. Oh. And it's because all those years ago, we actually locked the staff in the school.
Brilliant.
Yes, it says that. Yeah.
Excellent.
I had a couple of questions here. What is this horse? Gymkhana?
Oh, it's a very English thing. A Gymkhana is a kind of jumping competition which little girls and boys who are lucky enough to have ponies go to.
Show off. It's actually the word comes from India. It's one of those Indian words that's coming to the English language.
There's a fabulous John Betjeman poem. Uh-huh. It's awfully hard luck on Diana, and
it's all about the Gymkhana. It's a very, very British thing.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to point out in the, and probably you all noticed it, the brilliant use of water in the fourth paragraph. They watched tributaries joining the stream, and then we had to pool at the gates.
Yeah.
The pond grew into a sea. It was the river at an estuary. That was wonderful. That whole paragraph was
wonderful. Maybe it was a bit overdone.
No. There are two very brilliant extended metaphors. There's the horsey one
and the water one.
Yeah. And no, it's not over the top. I really like it.
I thought both of them were excellent.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that the horsey one, which was beautifully written, together with the water one, didn't fit.
I think it's fun.
I
was still reveling in
it. It's a separate paragraph. It's a separate you know, there's a little bit in between. And you know, I did, when I first read it, I thought, oh, mixed metaphors, and I thought, no, it's just great fun. I think it's really good. Critique. Okay, is to fling lazily an oxymoron? Because fling is a bit energetic.
Maybe.
I put I thought carelessly might have been better.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I didn't really like the horsey paragraph, because I thought it was kind of, it felt to me like filler and too much. It was just too many horses and too much about the horses. Right. And we just didn't need to know that they matched
so well, don't they? So amongst the school children, there are frisky ones, eager to please. There are bored ones. There are people, you know, children exhausted from a day's work.
Right.
Ponies that long to be beautiful bays, in other words, want to grow up.
Yeah.
And the occasional unbroken piebald or wild. I think it works. But obviously, you know, there are differences of opinions. That's just one of those things.
I find it very difficult to critique a memoir, because it's what's in your head.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's what you remember.
Yeah, but I think for me, memoir, if you want people to read memoir, you've got to tell the story in a way that makes them want to.
This is creative writing. This is creative writing. It's not a photograph.
Yeah.
No, but I just find it hard to critique because it's I feel it's so personal to that person. That apart from, you know, if it was a spelling mistake or a situation.
But she's volunteering it for critique.
Yes, I would like you to critique.
But I agree with
you. I'm interested with what Linda says about overdoing the horses.
Yeah, but I agree with you, Heather. It's very difficult sometimes for me to, other than to find, as you said, some punctuation or a spelling or something, or maybe an oddly phrased.
Well, maybe you could
sentence.
Help me with this one, then, because as I was reading, it says, between Fred and us, there were two large metal gates standing open across the driveway, which led to the staff car park and the main school buildings, but it didn't. It led from the staff car park and the school buildings.
So I became confused about whether the kids were on the inside or the outside. And that's why. I haven't actually identified the fact that it was because you'd put two instead of from.
And also between the school and the houses, because in my head I could see Pump Lane with the houses opposite, whereas the reader wouldn't have known that.
Because you've changed this perspective. You've created this bystander, which is brilliant. I think it works brilliantly.
I like that.
Well, you're going to disagree now. That's good.
I'm just not sure you need him.
Yeah.
Well, I like that somebody was observing this.
I think so. You could say what he
must have seen while doing that.
I thought it was good that, you know, they think that, or you think that he can't have identified anybody because everybody's going to look.
I think the old gentleman added, you know, him hearing the thunder, I think it added a nice note of tension and build up to the whole thing.
I loved that image. Distant rumble of hundreds of blackbird feet.
I like the tinnitus in his fog field ears.
That's why we're struggling to critique it. There's not an awful lot to critique.
I wouldn't have given him a name.
Wouldn't you?
And I think the title, What the Old Gentleman Saw,
that's
might
a good
be better.
One.
And also, you know, I think it's a flash fiction, isn't it?
Oh, it could be very well. Yeah.
You know, it could be. It could be submitted somewhere as
it's a story
flash
in itself.
Fiction.
Yeah.
Little thing, satchels of books.
Don't need of books.
No. You could just have satchels or heavy satchels.
And I thought even the odd no longer needed school tie, why not just redundant school tie?
And I've got hyphens in that part. Did you
notice? Yes.
Correctly
no longer needed. I quite like no longer needed. It's a little bit more.
The people that were leaving school that term, obviously they were tying their ties and it had their Cash's name tape on.
Oh.
So you wouldn't tie your tie if you were
staying,
going back the next
term.
It sounds like a jolly jape, well planned.
Excellent.
And now I think we're going to learn something from Heather about the difference between Cajun language and Creole language. As you probably know by now, Heather has spent some weeks in the United States touring Louisiana.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned language because the difference is not necessarily in the language. I tried to research this because I was interested when we were there trying to work out the difference. I found some very, very good websites that came up with very, very complicated reasons that they're different. But I found a website called tripsavvy.com and I thought that was a much more simplified version. So the origin of Cajun are descendants of French Canadians who relocated from Nova Scotia to Louisiana. They originally settled in rural southern Louisiana, but over time have spread throughout the state. Their cuisine, smoked, stewed and spicy dishes of meat, seafood and rice. So that's Cajun. Creole, those of European descent who were born in the French and Spanish colonies. The cuisine, traditional gourmet French food with multiple influences. And they lived in the heart of Creole culture in New Orleans. So Cajun people are descended from the French Canadian settlers who first began settling in Nova Scotia, an area they called Lacadie. In 1605, after 150 years of relatively peaceful farming and fishing on the edge of the Bay of Fundy, these people were expelled when Canada fell to the British rule. So the Brits were the enemy. Mm-hmm. The Brits came in and...
Do you mean Canada or Canada?
Yes, I think it is quite confusing because they call themselves Arcadians.
Right, right, that's right.
That's, and not from, yeah, that's not from Canada, that's from Lacardi. Mm-hmm.
So they founded a new Arcadia in Canada. That was, yes, what, yeah, they called,
because
their
an
place.
Arcadia means a place of safety.
Right, right. Paradise on
paradise,
earth.
Yes, yeah, which comes from the Greek. So basically, the Cajun people settled in the rural parts. And they fished and lived in the swamps and the bayou. Now, Creole, as a term, a bit more complicated than Cajun, in that it has multiple definitions. The simplest and shortest, but probably the least relevant, definition of Creole is born in the colonies. In early sources from the Louisiana colony, you'd see references to Creole horses, considered stronger because they were born and raised in the Louisiana heat. Creole tomatoes were developed in the early 1900s as hardy variety that grew well in Louisiana heat. But Creole came to refer to people of European descent who were born in the French and Spanish colonies, and later often implied people of mixed European and African and occasionally Native American descent. You'll hear references to white Creoles or old line Creole families, and people are starting to trace back mm-hmm. their mm-hmm. heritage.
Yeah.
And because they were part of the French and Spanish colonies, a lot of French speakers, and the Arcadians speak French because of their the French rule in Canada, mm. and, you know, as in Quebec, you know, speaking mm-hmm. French. Mm-hmm. But the last little bit I thought was really quite interesting. The short answer, if you're in New Orleans, Creole means fancy and Cajun means rustic. If you're in Acadiana, Cajun country, Creole means black and Cajun means white. Either way, if you're in South Louisiana and you hear of a really good Cajun or Creole restaurant, you're very probably safe in assuming that the food is going to be delicious.
Absolutely. Great.
Absolutely.
You just love to go there.
Yeah. Yeah. It was absolutely yeah. fantastic.
And the music that comes yes. out of Cajun country is just fabulous.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to look at the site, it does talk about, you know, where some of the musical origins yeah.
okay.
start as
and
well.
And what is the site?
It's called TripSavvy.
TripSavvy.com. Okay.
One V.
All right. Thank you, Heather. And now, as promised in the beginning of the program, we said we're going to be talking about memoir and fiction. And what are the differences? What are the ways in which they're the same? What are all the crossovers? Because there's sometimes fiction that reads like memoir, autobiographies and that read like fiction, and how writing what you know figures into these forms. So I would like to start by just offering a very basic definition of some of these things. Now, I don't think we need to know the definition of fiction other than to say that it's entirely made up. Memoir focuses on a segment or a theme in your life. It's small, not like a biography. Memoir answers the question. Memoir recognizes that life is not just what happens, but what you do with what happens. The story, the meaning, the subjective truth. And it's more internally focused. It deals with the emotions, the experience of the time, not just the data or what was going on, but the emotions and the way that you experienced whatever the event would be. Autobiography is the report of a life, far more than longer than memoir most of the time, and it focuses on what happened, not why did it happen, but what happened. It's usually externally focused on the events or the fact of a life. It focuses on chronology of the entire life, while memoir covers one specific aspect of the writer's life. William Zinsser, in his book, his Bible we all have, I think, called Writing Well, says when you're doing memoir, think small. Think small. Choose one memorable time. What made it memorable? What was it there that gave you the desire to write about that? And I liked his advice. Think small. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you can write it longer, but you want to have this one event in your life mm-hmm. not going on and
or
on.
Or one relationship.
Yeah.
Or one hobby. Or,
right.
But mm-hmm. as you say, it's a theme that
Right.
So it might run through a life, but it's not the whole life. It's right. Particular. That's right. Specific, yeah.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot of memoir lately, and right now I've just finished reading Mary Carr's book, The Liars Club. And she focuses on, while it covers a great many years of her life, the focus is on the fact that her mother is alcoholic and unreliable, and the way they had to live, etc. The mother who said, anything you want to do is okay, just do it, very often, and not feeling any limits or boundaries.
And isn't it fair to say as well that memoir has to be written in first person?
Yes, voice? Yes, it does. And then there's a biographical fiction where you're writing fiction, but much of it is based on, I suppose, Mary Magdalene is biographical fiction because, as I said, you know, it's based on my memories of living in the 50s in Appalachia and the preacher father and wanting to escape the confines of what. So I think that although I wasn't Mary Magdalene at all and Daddy wasn't Eli, it's just all of those things. So do you think that would classify then as autobiographical fiction?
Well, I don't think so, because you're not fiction. Mary Magdalene, and you didn't go on a road trip, and so it's, I would say, fiction with some autobiographical elements.
Inspiration. Inspiration. I mean, my lack in grace is inspired by a true story, and some of the events that I use in it are actual events that I know to have happened, but most of it is a complete fiction.
Well, also because when you're looking back in family history, which is you know, partly what Lack in Grace is doing, I think that's fair to say, you only know certain salient facts. You have to invent the rest.
You have to invent the bits and so in between,
So then it might start perhaps with an ancestor and what happened to them. But as soon as you start to invent that personality and invent the events, you've made them into a fictional character. Yeah, you have to.
Yeah.
But a lot of writing will use your own personal experience.
Yes. Of course.
Because your own experience of life, your own views on life, you're not necessarily writing about those things.
No.
But that's going to influence.
Of course, But memoir is where you're actually trying to tell.
Yes.
It's a true story. Yeah. It's a conscious telling of a true story.
Yeah. As his autobiography.
I definitely found when I joined Write Club here, everything I did in the beginning was based on memoir. It was thinly disguised. And it's only really with the Brianne story that I've branched out into trying to create something entirely imaginary, where those things didn't happen to me. Although some of it is a little bit like that.
Yeah.
And then there's, I think Truman Capote may have coined the phrase faction, or the title faction, didn't he, when he was writing his book In Cold Blood, because he went to research this true event that happened when people were murdered. And yet, in the beginning, the reason he called it that was because some people said, well, wait a minute, this is not necessarily all true. So he called it faction because he had to make up a lot of the things to go in with the facts in order to make an interesting book.
I found a Guardian article following the publication of Portraits from Life by Jerome Boyd Mansell, and it was talking about the novelist memoir being a subgenre, if slippery when it comes to the truth is the word that it said. And I'll just read from the article. It says, the thin line between fact and fiction in the autobiographies of novelists is often wafer thin. In his 1906 memoir, The Mirror of the Sea, Joseph Conrad slips at many points into outright fiction. Henry James has long been criticised for reworking documentary materials, retouching letters he quoted in A Small Boy and others. And Ford Madox Ford, his reminiscences are perhaps the most notorious for making things up, but he never pretended otherwise. This book is full of inaccuracies as to facts, he declared in Ancient Lights, but its accuracy as to impressions is absolute.
Well, it's interesting because when my sister and I talk about what happened to us when we were children, we've got very diverse memories of what happened. Even when you think you're talking about something that actually happened, two people can remember it very differently.
That's a good point.
And also, particularly as a child, you are the centre of the universe, and it's all happening to you, mm. and other people having the same experience have a very different point of view on that.
Mm. Well, that's why people fall out when people write memoirs of their lives, isn't it? Because they remember things, or they reveal things that did happen, and people would rather they didn't reveal them.
My brother lived in a completely different family than I did. Because his memory of things is just completely different.
So your memoirs would be completely different.
Absolutely, absolutely.
There was a recent case in the paper about some celebrity who published either a memoir or autobiography and talked about dating Natalie Portman, and she completely refuted his version of events. Yeah. And there's a big sort of Twitter storm about it.
Oh, really?
Apparently.
Really?
Oh, yeah, so it is. I mean, and you don't know whose version is the right one. No, did either of them remember it correctly?
You would have to be very careful. But you can't just change names because people still recognise themselves.
Or they think you're writing.
Or they think so.
Because I've written a weekly newsletter for years, and I regularly, in the early days particularly, got people writing saying, how dare you talk about me? And I wasn't actually talking about them at all. I was describing someone completely different.
Right.
Strange.
You've just explained why I enjoy some memoirs more than autobiographies, because autobiographies can be a little bit cold and clinical, can't they? If they tell you what happened, right, but they don't tell you how the person felt about what happened, it can all be a little bit a recitation of dates and events, can't it?
It's not something that I read very much, autobiography or memoir.
I can't join in this conversation because I don't read memoir, and then I looked at my bookshelf and got a bit of a shock. So I think memoir got a bad name with all those misery manuals. Dave Peltzer's A Boy Called It, and Briscoe Ugly, Granddad's Funeral by Kate Skylark.
There's a whole section of misery
manuals. To me, those are prurient, voyeuristic, and there's always a very unrealistic I Lived Happily Ever After thing.
And there was a definite taint of publishers jumping on bandwagon.
Absolutely.
And exploiting people's suffering.
Yeah. But then I looked at my bookshelf, having said I don't read memoir, and just in the last few months, I read This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay, which is, I know I've passed it around to several
fantastic
people. It's a memoir of a junior doctor in the British National Health Service. A book that you recommended, Pat, by Lucy Mangan, Bookworm, A Memoir of Childhood Reading. I've got that on my Sundoku. I'm going to be reading it soon. I've been watching the Corfu Durrells,
the trilogy.
My Family and Other Animals. I love those books. Got them on my bookshelf. Would never part with them. All memoir. Nella Last Diaries. Has anybody heard of Nella Last? She was a housewife number something or other.
Housewife number 49.
But her and Victoria Wood did a play on her. But the actual books of Nella Last Diary, I've read loads of them because they're all set in the Second World War, and obviously that was part of my research for the period. I've also read In Tearing Haste, which is in the last year, which is the Patrick Leigh Fermor Debs Devonshire, but that's not really a memoir because that's...
No, I've read a biography of Patrick Leigh Fermor.
But I don't read autobiography and memoir. Those letters, I suppose, they are edited by Charlotte Mosley, interesting, so I suspect one of the Mosley clan. But, you know, some people might say that, because that is true life, isn't it, letters? But it's not really memoir. It's more a kind of historical source.
My favourite books of all time, if you put a gun to my head and said, you've got to take these with you, but nothing else, it would be The Rainbow Comes and Goes, which is written by Diana Cooper, Artemis's mum, and it was between her and Duff Cooper between the wars, and it was simultaneous.
Is it a memoir?
It's a series of letters as memoirs, and it bridges the gap for me nicely, because it taught me about the time and what happened and how, you know, the political events unfolded, but it also talked about their feelings because they were writing letters to each other. So it bridges the gap for me nicely.
And the Mitford Girls is amazing to read as well, and the letters backwards and forwards.
I have read Love in a Cold Climate, which I suppose is sort of memoir, though I think it's heavily fictionalised.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so it's faction.
Yeah.
Right.
And the other one that I have read, X-Ray, the unauthorised autobiography of Ray Davies, which he wrote himself. And I don't think it was ghostwritten. I mean, that's the other thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of these autobiographies will be ghostwritten anyway. But yeah. I think in his case, he wanted to write it like a novel.
Mm. Well, let me give you a subgenre of the biographical fiction. Wow. And the definition of that one is books that are based on a historical person with fiction aspects added. Mm-hmm. The time period of the person's life may be accurate, for instance, but the circumstances of their life may be changed.
Yeah.
So, example.
So, Carol McGraw would be right.
Exactly. The most historical fiction.
Yeah. Yes, so in writing about Thomas Cromwell's first wife, there are certain facts known, but most of it we don't know. And so the author can then play within
Philippa
those
Gregory,
spaces.
All of her will be biographical fiction.
Right, here. The Other Boleyn Girl by Philippa Gregory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A novel of Zelda Fitzgerald by Therese Ann Fowler. Mm-hmm. Aviator's Wife by Melanie Benjamin. Lacuna by Barbara Keene Salver.
Mm. It certainly has the Lacuna, fabulous book. It is a work of fiction, but there are historical characters in it. Diego Rivera, Frida Kahlo.
But you've got the trouble with that, with a biographical fiction, saying it's got fact in it. It's like, you know, the princes in the tower. You end up with people going, oh, they didn't really die, this happened to them, which is actually something that somebody put in a historical novel, and it's not fact at all.
Right.
It's fiction, and nobody really knows. And I think sometimes it's
subverting the real hard facts.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard. Well, just making facts up, and then that becomes...
Right.
But that's what we do, writers. We make stuff up.
Yeah, we're doing it.
Right.
We tell stories.
That's right. We tell stories. But then there's also historical fiction, which seems to me that biographical fiction, if it's based on a historical person, and then historical fiction, I don't know, I think I would not be able to identify the difference.
The difference is, if I write a story set in Tudor England that's completely fictional characters, then that's historical fiction. Obviously, there are overlaps in all these things.
Well, this one says, historical fiction genre places real world people in real world places or events with several fictionalized or dramatized elements.
That memoir is a true story told in the first person by the person who experienced it.
Right.
I read an article about some Faith Ringgold, who's a black American quilter, artist, but most of her art is produced in quilts. And she wrote a memoir called We Flew Over the Bridge. And one of the reviews of that started by saying, a memoir is revealing on two levels, since it's selective remembering. What the author chooses to tell us about herself ends up telling us something additional. And I just thought that was a really sort of interesting perspective.
Yeah.
In the way that, I mean, to some extent, autobiography will do the same, because it will be selective and you only get certain things.
But also, by writing it, you reveal what you think is important, what you think about the events, your opinions and ideas and attitudes, and you may reveal more than you think or intend to.
So if our listeners are thinking they might like to start with writing memoir, what do they do?
Well, Anne Richardson is going to talk with us about that in our guest interview today. Anne is a friend of ours who she facilitates a memoir group every week, and she herself has done many oral histories, which was an interesting thing she got into in the interview, and she'll talk a lot about that. So let's listen to Anne.
Brilliant.
We're here today with Anne Richardson, who facilitates a memoir group. She's published oral histories for other people, and she's done a lot of memoir work herself. Hello, Anne.
Good morning, Linda.
Thank you for joining us today. Anne, would you tell us, to begin with, when you're writing a memoir or doing your oral histories for others, is it basically for catharsis or is it for other reasons?
Well, I think it's for whatever the reason that the person themselves, if they're writing a diary or a journal or autobiographical essays about their family or their own lives, I think it sort of depends on how that person approaches the subject. And I have found in looking over various memoirs, you know, in bookstores, that sometimes the catharsis for other people is not necessarily interesting to an outside reader or observer. And I've come across that a number of times where I didn't really want to have to go through the sort of mud of somebody else's life if it's going to be just sort of spilled out. And there are plenty of authors who can do it in a way in which their lives are more accessible. You can understand what their trials and tribulations were, and yet they're more acceptable and not so, as you say, cathartic. Although it may be cathartic for them, but you always have to think about what the reader is going to, how the reader is going to react.
You mentioned journaling. Would you consider journaling memoir writing?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yes.
Could you talk about that? I mean, journals are not something that people would normally want to publish. It's a, for a personal remembrance, is it not?
Well, again, it depends on who the person is. If you're Virginia Woolf, you have an eye toward publication.
Good point.
And if you're Anne Richardson, you have an eye toward what I'm thinking and feeling. And in some ways, however, wishing that my children would read these things, because I'm sure they would learn a lot about their mother. But so again, it depends on, you know, who the person is. And eventually some people's diaries get published and they had no intention of having that happen.
That's
also
true. Well, how do you approach doing an oral history with someone else?
It's at University of California at Berkeley. They have a group of people who go out and interview quote unquote important people. And they have a certain set of rules, and they're trying to get people who have made a difference in terms of the history or the cultural climate or something like that. Anyway, they have certain rules and regulations about what the interview is going to be like. And I've never followed that.
So how do you begin with an oral history?
Well, I start with the person, and often it's very difficult to get them to, they want to, but they are also afraid or apprehensive. And I found that if you can get through the first half an hour, then they forget the tape recorder and then they start talking. I had a client who's a very tied up kind of person, but once he started talking, it just came out like a, you know, like a river, and we had many, many hours of interview. And in terms of the catharsis idea, what I've found in the people that I've interviewed is not so much that, I wouldn't have used that word, but I would have used the word transformative, that they look back on their lives in a different way. And I'm certainly not a psychologist, I've had no training in that area, but just allowing or sometimes pushing people to describe their lives gives them a chance to see themselves in a different way.
I think that's very interesting. Be true, of course, that if you're looking back at your life from a different age, you're going to see things, I think, differently than they were when you were a child. Perhaps clearer, or do people generally try to talk about their experiences as they were experienced as a child?
I think that's an interesting question. It's just a matter of memory, that this is what I remember and this is what this car looked like and this was how the desert felt, whatever it is. And not so much from the child voice, but more of an adult reminiscing. For instance, one of my clients cried for the first week we were interviewing, and at the end, when this book was published, she just said, I see now that my life, I can feel happy about it, and I can laugh about it now. And that was a total different attitude to which she entered into the process.
That must be extremely rewarding when you hear things like that from people that you're working with.
I was going to talk a little bit about these, well, the family histories that I did were before the days of, you know, that you can do it on your computer, self-publishing. And mostly these people were in their 60s, 70s. Mm. And one client was quite difficult. She said, I'm not important. I don't have any reputation. I'm not important in the world. And I said, well, look, what you're doing is important because you're bringing people from the past. You're bringing them alive. And I heard her the next week telling her somebody downstairs. She said, well, I'm going to go upstairs and bring some people back alive. And I thought, good, I've got her. You know, I've got her. And she did a great, great memoir. Very painful. She had a very bad, very alcoholic mother. And when it was all over, she said, thank God. She said, it's been told.
Oh.
So, and I, in the preparation for this, you talked about the coexistence or non of the biography or autobiography or memoir and fiction.
Yes.
And I thought of a couple of examples. For instance, Robert Graves wrote a book about his World War I experience. It's called Goodbye to All That. And it's a very famous book and very interesting and well written, as Graves would do. But there is some skepticism about whether or not it's entirely true. Mm-hmm. I believe it, a fellow author said, who also had the same experiences, said, well, maybe it was a little enhanced. And there's another author, too, an unusual author, but this book is worth looking for. It's called Voices by Frederick Prokosh. And it's a memoir, and it's fascinating. And he talks about a lot of people that he met, but there's also skepticism about how true all of his words were. And just to sort of follow up on that, I think that it's pretty well known that many authors put their lives into their books. Mm-hmm. For instance, yes. Anthony Trollope, if you read his autobiography, it's very clear that, especially in his Palliser series, he's coming out of his own life, his own interest in Parliament and things like that. So, and I just wanted to say that if anybody's very interested in terms of what's psychology and memoir, how that appears into fiction, there's a very excellent book called The Wound and the Bow by Edmund Wilson, who was a major American essayist in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And it's a very interesting study on how lives then get translated into fiction.
Mm.
I always think that if you're writing a memoir, it's got to be very difficult to go into some things that you might want to enhance or fictionalize a little bit. Do you find that true?
Are you talking from my point of view or other people's point of view?
From your point of view.
Well, I mean, I do know people who started out in autobiography and then switched to make it a fictionalized story.
Okay. Yeah.
And
is that because sometimes the real truth is a little too difficult to relay, or perhaps doesn't make them look good, or why?
It's more of, I think, maybe possibly getting distance.
Uh-huh.
And maybe it's a little too raw for either the author or the audience, depending.
Right. I'd like to hear a little bit about the kind of writing you do, your personal writing, because I know that you do essay-length memoir, and it's very interesting. Would you mind just reading a passage or two to us, just to give an example of the way you work?
I can do that. This is Sunday, 24th, December 2017 at 11:40 a.m. And so I go back to my writing post, eye to eye with Sappho and her poised pen. Well, I wanted a day without deadlines, and I've got one. Yet the sharks of the shoulds are circling around, looking for the fat of procrastination to feed upon. So I shall make my list. Began earlier reading the Cambridge Book of English Verse, and have discovered a poet named Edwin Muir. Like me, his conception of his own childhood was idyllic, and he tried to reconnect with it through his poetry. He too went through many struggles until in the 30s he married the right and necessary woman and eventually underwent psychoanalysis and came out on the other side of darkness. Perhaps this new influx is reason for my creation on the other side of this page. My question, how can I combine the force and honor and beauty of the world with the quivering innocence and fluid architecture of that open sea anemone of tidal feeling that sweeps over me so often? Is that the eyeless eye that Tully and Chodron espouse, or is it a gentle madness, a place in which I want to stay and yet from which I want to escape? I will let it be and see what issues forth. Perhaps it is the seeding field of salvation.
Thank you for reading that. You have a wonderful way of describing things. Wonderfully descriptive vocabulary. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
Let's talk a little bit about your memoir group, the group that you founded. I think it's been running now for, what, 3-4 years
Maybe
more?
Five years.
How did you set this up?
Well, it started after I gave a lecture in Stupa, or a talk, let's put it that way. And then people just became interested because of my thoughts on memoir and the necessity of it. And I think it's the, speaking of that, I think it's the one thing that you can give to your family, to your children, forget the silver and the china and the whatever else, and give them your life. I think that is absolutely more important than anything else. And it's amazing how many ripples that can engender.
Right. Without, of course, identifying the particular members of the group, can you talk a little about how the, what their approach is?
Well, there's one woman who's doing a whole sociocultural reflection on the place where she grew up. So she's also talking about place and giving us an idea of what that was like, what that particular place was like. She's also very good at dialogue, of which I have no ability whatsoever, which is why I don't write fiction. And then there was one member who does a lot of poetry, and that works. And we usually have a free write of some kind, which brings forth all sorts of interesting ideas and hilarity much of the time. And then we usually read our pieces to each other.
I see. Are the free writes on any particular topic, and do they confine themselves to memories?
Yes, it's memoir based. So, and usually one of the participants picks a subject, or it happens to be a holiday or something like that. And we write for 10 minutes. Or more, depending on whose pen can keep scratching. It's a very good way to start out.
And do people find that they can use these things in the memoirs they're writing?
I don't know that there's anybody who's going for absolute publication. However, I think this woman who's writing about her home place will probably, it will end up in a public library, something like that, because it's very valuable in terms of the history of that area.
Do you have anything to say about memoir versus fiction?
All I can say is that I enjoy working on one element, and there's no way that I can do the other. So, I have no gift for fiction whatsoever.
So this has been decided for you by where you think your talents lie.
Where I know it does, okay. Or where my deficits lie, let's put it that way. Dialogue, for instance.
How did you get started writing a memoir?
Well, I had a grandfather who had been very involved in the life of San Francisco, and he was a great storyteller, and he used to tell us stories, and often the same ones, over and over again. And as a child, I used to think, oh my God, if I have to hear this again, you know, and as children do. And nobody taped him there. And then of course I couldn't remember half of what he'd said. And I found that a great tragedy because it would have been very valuable, not just for his family, but for the history of San Francisco. I also felt in the middle of my life when I was going through a rough time that I wished my grandmothers had written something to tell me what their lives were like, what was happening in their marriages, what was going on with them, so I would have some sort of link to female models. And for me, that was a personal, like, tragedy is too big a word, a personal disappointment. And I thought that I would devote whatever creative energies I have to not letting that happen again for other people.
Very good. I know that I have often, as an adult, wished I had asked my mother questions, basically, when I was growing up. She was my mother, and she didn't have another life, as you know, from my point of view. And now I'd like to know, what were your aspirations? What were your dreams? What would you have done had you been free to do so, because she was a housewife and very subjugated to my father. And I've often wondered about her more as an individual, and I didn't ask the questions, and I wish I had.
Well, I'm always prompting people to do that with their relatives who are still alive. And one thing that we haven't talked about, Linda, that I think is important is this whole idea of truth.
Yes.
And what do you tell?
Right.
And I believe it was Anne Lamott who said that if you're a family that has a writer in it, you're finished. And it's a very difficult question. And I had one client who wanted to tell the truth about how she felt about her mother, but she didn't think she could because her brother was still alive. Mm-hmm. And many, you know, incidents like that. On the other hand, a couple of my clients were very truthful, and you let the chips fall where they may.
Telling parts of their lives that weren't necessarily all that.
Or somebody else's.
Right.
You know, if you're writing about your parent, your mother, your father, or yourself.
Yeah.
And how much truth do you tell? And it's a question to be investigated.
Right. Right. I understand that one of the members of the group has been writing about all of the jobs he used to have,
mm-hmm.
the many different types of work he's done in his life. And something like that, I would think, would be useful in a library in the place where he
Absolutely.
Was working, to tell the kinds of things that are very different from our technology now. I would think that would be useful to schools or libraries as well. Is that your thought?
No question. And I think the other thing that I tried to do was to encourage people to describe things that no longer exist. And for one client, I kept saying, just imagine you're writing this for your grandchildren. What did an icebox look like? What was a rumble seat? What, you know, what were the cars like when you grew up? And he was born in 1921, so you can imagine. And with that kind of focus, that you're really writing this for people who may have no idea that there such a world existed. I think that's also very important, and to broaden it so that it does become part of a cultural context. So that the woman that I interviewed in Chicago came from a Norwegian family, and there was a lot of alcoholism in the immigrant Norwegian communities. That was often the case. And so that becomes representative of a certain time and place also.
Right, and perhaps certain emotional states about being transplanted from one place to another.
Absolutely.
Yeah. As we come to a close here, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you think would be important to add?
All I will say in closing is that get a microphone, get a tape recorder, and go chase down everybody in your family that can tell you something that will be lost if you don't.
That's right. That's a good idea. And perhaps a list of questions prepared beforehand that might have to do with the time and place in which that person lived.
Well, sometimes it is necessary to do research.
Yeah.
But I don't do it ahead of time. I pretty much do it as it goes on, and I find out what's needed. And reading books.
And
going into the historical context of what they're talking about.
Well, thank you, Anne. I think that our listeners are going to be very interested in what you had to say about memoir and its various uses. So thanks again for being with us.
Well, you're more than welcome.
Well, that was fascinating, wasn't it?
It was.
It's obviously can be quite traumatic, and maybe that's also a thing that why I avoid this kind of writing as well.
I think sometimes
too many cans of worms.
It does. Yeah. Sometimes it's easier to kind of put some ideas into your fiction and tell the story that way with but I can see why people want to do it.
I really wish I'd taken a tape recorder to my mother-in-law, because she escaped from Russia during the pogroms, came to live in London at the turn of the century, lived in Notting Hill at the turn of last century, and worked in a beautiful salon, you know, embroidering evening gowns for ladies, and then she became best friends with someone who worked in the Nigerian embassy and the Indian embassy, and went to all the events there catering behind the scenes. So you know, just to ask her about her life would have been absolutely fascinating.
So it sounds like
an oral history that could have been turned into a memoir. Nobody knows she's died, sadly, and nobody knows that now.
That's why we should never throw letters, photographs, all those things away. I mean, that's the only thing that really matters, isn't it?
Well, yes, but you don't actually need 10 photos of your grandchild riding the horse at the supermarket.
that's not revealing anything about the family. Good stuff.
But those old photos are great. I've got one, and I don't know where it came from, but a fabulous photo of my granny in her tram driver's uniform when she drove a tram in Glasgow during the First World War. And I just think, you know, then you suddenly realise, she didn't just have babies.
I found a lovely photograph, which I did ask my grandmother about, and it's a photograph of her reading a book with my grandfather leaning over her shoulder in probably the early 1920s. And I remember saying to her, "Oh, you know, you look like you're getting cosy there." And she said, "We were reading Married Life by Marie Stokes." She said it was really, really risque, and they weren't married when they were reading it. He was reading it over her shoulder, and I thought, "Oh, wow!" And I've kept that picture, and there's a wonderful story to be told around that.
Yes, there is.
Well, I just think the whole idea of it, it's really intriguing. And there are so many ways to do it. And I just think that maybe if you're journaling, you could use that to get yourself a start and going on it. Or if you need someone like Anne, who's a facilitator for recording your family history or your oral history, that's helpful too. But I think it's very important to get them down. So now, we're almost finished. There's just time for Pat and Helen Siddharts to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Pat, what's on your bedside table?
I'm reading The Silence of the Girls. Quite ironic, really, in the circumstances. I'm reading The Silence of the Girls by Pat Barker. There seem to be quite a few retellings of the Iliad and the Odyssey and all those sort of classical stories going around at the moment, and this particular one features Briseis. Briseis was a sort of side character in Homer's Iliad. The Iliad is basically about the feud between Agamemnon and Achilles as they are the Greeks who are attacking Troy, and it all focuses, the quarrel focuses on the fact that Agamemnon takes his bed slave Briseis away from him, and Briseis was Achilles' trophy. When they sacked Lyonessus, she saw her husband, her brothers killed, all the women are taken, and then they are just sort of dished out, really. And at the Greek encampment, she's paraded around a vast arena of catcalling men and assessed for distribution. And Achilles grabs her chin and says, "Cheers, lads, she'll do." And the book's full of this sort of kind of modern language. It's not told in a sort of classical style. A lot of the novel, really, or Pat Barker's telling of the story, because she focuses entirely on Briseis and tells everything from her perspective. So instead of getting the stories of the great battles and the great warriors, as one of the women who is not expected to speak up, all they see is, you know, the wounded men coming back, and she sees them, you know, taking their armor off and all that kind of thing. And it's about who tells the stories, and instead of it being you know, the stories of great honour that the men will tell. This is the woman, the women's story. And Brisees actually wonders, says, what will they make of us, the people of those unimaginable distant times? One thing I do know, they won't want the brutal reality of conquest and slavery. They won't want to be told about the massacres of men and boys, the enslavement of women and girls. They won't want to know we were living in a rape camp. Terrible. And it's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
Really well told, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
Oh, sounds like good. One to put on the old Sundoku. Mm.
It's in my Sundoku, and now I'm going to pull it to the top and read it. Thank you, Pat. So now we can hear what Helen Siddards, who gave us such good advice on our podcast about well-being for writers a while back. She's a yoga teacher, and here she's telling us what's on her bedside table.
So one that I'm reading, but I don't read this in bed because I think I'd find it difficult to fall asleep after it. You Are the Placebo by Dr. Joe Dispenza. And it's all about how your mind and your body work, you know, how your body is basically built to repair itself. This guy, I think he had some, he was in a triathlon or something. He had some horrendous accident and his spine was broken in God knows how many places, and they were going to put rods in and stuff like that. He decided not to have the surgery, you know, healed himself. I think he started off at the time when he had this horrendous accident, he was an osteopath or a chiropractor, I'm not quite sure. But it's all about, you know, what he discovered about how the mind and body can heal themselves. And he obviously has stories of people who've achieved this for themselves, but also a lot about the science behind that. So it's, and I, you know, one of the things I'm really fascinated about is how our bodies work. And so that's why I'm reading that one.
Thanks, Helen. That sounds like a very interesting read. And now it's time to go. Thank you for joining us once again. Help us to reach more people and grow our podcast. Tell a friend about Write Club, and maybe your friend will tell a friend. Subscribe so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And join our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club the Podcast on Facebook. And tell us about your work, your struggles, or your successes. Leave us a review. We love to hear from you, and we do respond. And now we're going to go sit on Steph's front porch and enjoy a little silver pitcher of mint julep she stirred up for us. We'll be back again next Monday, same time, same station. Y'all come back now here.
Bye. Bye.